All the answers are right there in the literature, and they get ignored. It's just horrendous, the connection between how we care or don't care for our infants and the tremendous personal and social problems we have.
You're listening to The Brendan Morata Show.
In this episode, I talked to Ronald Goldman, director of the Early Trauma Prevention Center. This episode is a deep exploration of early life trauma, what causes it, what the long-term impact of trauma is, and what you can do to prevent early life trauma. We also explore how many American social issues are caused by early life trauma. If you're someone who cares about social issues, the well-being of children, or someone who's simply been affected by the early experiences of your life, listen to this episode. Now, here is Ronald Goldman. I know that you're an expert in early life trauma, but I want to start with the question, what is trauma? Because I suspect that a lot of people who haven't studied this as much as you have may have misconceptions just about what trauma is. They might think it's only physical trauma or something really big, like a car wreck or something like that. So how is it that you define trauma?
Trauma is an overwhelming experience that exceeds our ability to respond or be present with it. So what happens very often is we go into a state of withdrawal psychologically from the experience to defend ourselves psychologically so that we can continue, because otherwise this would be a tremendous distraction to being present and subsequent experiences. So trauma is an extreme experience, and I often say it's a particularly in terms of early trauma, it can be a trauma of commission or a trauma of omission. And by that, I relate it to the satisfaction of early needs. And if early needs are not satisfied, they can have trauma-like consequences. And the experience can be either somebody having some physical abuse, which of course is a trauma of commission, and a trauma of omission is related to not getting an infant's needs satisfied. So for example, if there's lack of physical contact, that's a trauma of omission, and it's an important early need.
I really like that definition of an experience of overwhelm, because overwhelm has different definitions, or different people experience overwhelm over different things. And it sounds like by the clarification you gave around commission and omission, something could be traumatic simply because there was an experience that didn't happen as much as an experience that does. So what are the things that cause people to experience overwhelm? And is that different in different age groups? So for example, is a child's experience of what would overwhelm them different than, for example, an adult's?
Okay, well, again, my focus is on early trauma. So I'm looking at early childhood experience and primarily infant experience. So an example of early trauma for an infant, for example, would be, well, birth is very often an overwhelmingly traumatic experience for the infant. What happens there is 99% of births in the United States occur in hospitals. And they're very often unnecessary interventions in a natural process of birth. So these unnecessary interventions are primarily decided by a medical doctor who is trained to do these unnecessary interventions. Again, they're not always required, but they would say it's necessary. And what they often do, the doctors now, is they'll say, well, look, this is what I recommend. And if we don't do this, this is the risk you're taking. And then a mother giving birth would be afraid not to follow the doctor's recommendation. And then, again, it's become an intervention very often cascades to subsequent interventions. And just to continue with the birth experience, very often in this country, we have what are called cesarean births, which are births by surgery, not births the natural way. So one out of three births in this country are done by cesarean, which is a very large proportion. By comparison, back in 1965, the rate of cesarean birth was 4.5%. So this has consequences. I can go on, but am I answering your question?
Yeah, I'm also just curious, too, what makes something overwhelming for a young child or an infant versus, or I take it that most births or all births don't have to be overwhelming. So I'm curious what the distinction is between an experience that would simply be significant versus traumatic. In other words, birth is probably really significant for everyone, but it may not be traumatic for everyone. So I'm curious what the distinction is that makes a experience go from something that is an overwhelm of trauma versus just a significant experience.
Well, in some cases, it's personal. It's related to the person's psychological development and just how able they are to respond. Okay, if the person has many repressed feelings, which are likely due to early traumas, then that emotional repression diminishes the ability to respond to subsequent extreme experiences, because the person is repressing earlier trauma, earlier feelings, because they are beyond their ability, they were beyond their ability to respond. So they're unable to respond to subsequent feelings. So they tend to be in a state of emotional withdrawal. Okay, and often this is described in the literature, for example, a physical attack, certainly physical trauma often includes psychological trauma, but it can also be if someone screams extreme anger at you, there may not be any physical contact at all, but depending on the situation, that certainly for a young child now, they're much more vulnerable to these kinds of early traumatic experiences.
It sounds like the distinction you're making is that an overwhelming experience is one that we don't know how to respond to or don't have a way to respond to. Is that accurate to say?
Well, again, it's not a mental choice here. It's a sure. Body. It's a body choice.
Right.
It's beyond our decision-making options, so to speak. And the body, what's sometimes said is the body remembers what the mind forgets. So when the mind forgets it, that's suggesting disassociation, the psychological term, where there's a lack of awareness and recall, conscious recall. So that unconscious recall gets stored in the body as repressed emotions. And during certain kinds of therapy, that the repressed emotions can be recovered and actually relived. Even birth is able to be relived. We as adults don't remember much before we're 3 or 4 years old. So the unstated assumption tends to be that if I don't remember it, it probably wasn't very important, or it didn't matter, or I wasn't, you know, able to remember. The truth is, our early experiences, and particularly during infancy, are very important and have long-term effects. So, the lack of memory does not necessarily mean that this was insignificant.
So, if I'm understanding correctly, when someone experiences overwhelm or trauma early in life, and their body and their consciousness doesn't know how to respond, part of them will disassociate and attempt to leave the experience psychologically in some way. And that has a lasting impact on the person.
That's right.
So what is the lasting impact? Say someone has a very traumatic birth or traumatic early life experience, and they disassociate because of the trauma or overwhelm in that experience. What impact does that have on them, in both in that experience and later on in life?
Okay. Well, a primary long-term effect is, again, related to a disconnection from the overwhelming feelings involved. When those traumatic feelings are repressed, it affects our general ability to experience and express feelings. So we're less sensitive to our own feelings because we're literally defending ourselves internally from the overwhelming feelings. You follow what I just said?
Yes. So there's a feeling from the trauma that is now being repressed, and a lot of energy is going to that repression and then defending it from being seen by others and yourself. Is that accurate?
Okay. And I'm saying it has a general effect.
Okay.
On our ability to be emotionally sensitive, because we're repressing our feelings to defend against the early traumatic feelings, that has a general effect of being less sensitive to our feelings.
That's very important. Yeah. So it doesn't just affect that feeling, but all your feelings.
Right. It's a general repression or less sensitivity to our feelings. So, okay, here's another key point. When we're less sensitive to our feelings, we're less sensitive to other people's feelings. That is very important. When we're less sensitive to other people's feelings, it affects how we respond or don't respond to them.
How exactly does that manifest? So if we're less sensitive to our feelings, we're less sensitive to others' feelings, how would someone perceive or notice that there's that change in someone's emotional reactions later on in life? And how would you be aware of it in yourself or others? What's an example of that or evidence of that later in life?
Well, it's the lack of sensitivity on the part of others is they'll make decisions and behaviors that, for example, have negative impact on other people. So, and they'll make that decision because they're less sensitive to the feelings of other people. They have less empathy. So this affects our politics, for example. Some political decisions are made based on self-interest with a disregard for common interest. That's very serious. It's problematic, not only in our country, but quite a bit in our country. So that's an example. When you're less sensitive to other people's feelings, you're not conscious of their likely the effect on them, but you're doing something because you yourself may have some kind of benefit out of a particular decision. Am I being clear?
Yes.
Okay. That's very significant.
So I'm a big believer in what you're saying and the idea that the events early on in life impact us later on. But one of the things I've noticed when I talk to people about this idea is that there's a lot of skepticism and people who want to believe that as an adult, I'm in charge of making all my own decisions. You know, something bad might have happened to me in the past, but it doesn't affect me now. I'm fine. And I'm curious what you say to people when you encounter that skepticism or that disbelief in the idea that early life events affect us so dramatically later on.
Well, this reminds me of something I've seen in the literature, and that is, according to some studies, at least one third of people avoid the truth. The reason they avoid the truth is it's very discomforting. It hurts. They would much rather believe something that gives them the illusion of being connected to others than, for example, other people of the same political perspective, than believe something that appears to conflict with their perceived connection to others. So they deny it. And they will ignore, you can present them with evidence and more evidence, and they will either ignore it or say it can't possibly be true, because they're, it's almost like an addiction. It's a psychological addiction to a certain perspective of reality. And it's very difficult to change. So if I encounter somebody like that, I move on to somebody else. I don't want to waste my time with somebody like that. I have a limited amount of time. I want to be as effective as I can. So I seek people who are, one of the most common questions I ask about, for example, are you open to new information? That's great. If they hesitate to answer that question, that's a good key.
The phrase I've heard to describe that is, don't try to sell the unsellable.
Yeah, right.
I mean, if they're not interested, then, move on. But for those who are listening who are open to new information, what information would you suggest that they check out? Or if they're interested in finding more evidence of this or better understanding it, what are the places or ways that someone could learn more about it? And then also, what are the ways that someone could learn more about how their own early life events might have affected them? Because I know that the other thing that happens when I bring this up, talking to people, is they'll say, I had this thing happen when I was a kid and maybe that affected me, but I don't really know how, but I feel like it probably did. So what are the ways to learn more about this, both on the academic and informational level, and then also on the personal level?
Okay. I'll mention a few topics that I include in my speaking and my writing. And we're not going to have time for a lot of details, but again, the overview here. I mentioned hospital birth. Okay, there's also, of course, as we well know, the act of circumcision. Extremely traumatic, long-lasting effects, repressed anger and fear, distrust, particularly of the mother. An infant inherently trusts mother to take care of him or her. So what happens to the infant if an event like circumcision happens? How can you trust your mother? It's going to disrupt the relationship, the bond between the infant and mother. What else? Okay, then there's also other events. Again, we're talking about not satisfying infants' needs here. Infants have a need to be breastfed. In this country, what's common is bottle feeding. Okay, it's not natural. There's research on this. even the American Academy of Pediatrics recognizes the benefits of breastfeeding, even them. And for various reasons, it's not common in this culture. Moving on, separation. It's very common in this culture for infants to be separated from their mothers. It happens in about half of hospital births. Infants are removed and put in separate rooms, nurseries, to be cared for by staff. And then I think it was a few decades ago, actually, mothers started speaking up about, hey, I want my baby with me. Okay. And as a result of a growing number of mothers expressing that opinion, some hospitals started to change. Changing hospital policy is very difficult. It's not a quick thing. Okay. But over a period of years, a growing number of hospitals changed their policy to allow newborn infants to be in the room with the mother. They call it rooming in. At this point in our country, approximately one half of hospitals allow infants to be rooming in with their mothers. So that avoids the hospital separation. But then when the mothers and infants get home, what's very common? Well, we are the only country in the world that puts infants in separate beds and in separate rooms. Only country in the world. This is so unnatural. I mean, can you imagine a hunter-gatherer culture doing something equivalent to that with a newborn infant? Can you imagine any kind of primate doing something like that? It's beyond their awareness or consideration, but it has become a cultural practice over perhaps the last 100 years or so. So this isolation in the household is a trauma of omission. This infant needs virtually continuous contact with a mother or someone, a close relative, hopefully, substituting for mother, a minority at the time.
So I didn't realize that putting in the child or infant in a separate room was a uniquely American practice. Is co-sleeping the norm in most of the world?
No. They most people, they don't understand what we do. I mean, they don't understand a lot of things about America. They don't understand circumcision. I mean, it's not funny. This is very serious. It's just horrendous how we care or don't care for our infants. It creates, I mean, the point of my center is to make the connection between how we care for infants and the tremendous personal and social problems we have. We have a great deal of mental health problems in this country. Again, we have racism. We have violence. We have a tremendous amount of personal and social problems. And we're not making much progress. In some cases, getting worse. And again, been going on for many decades. So it's doing the best I can to raise awareness about, rather than just tolerating or trying to respond to these problems after they're deeply embedded, these problems aren't accidental. They're connected to early experience. So let's take a look at the origins and learn how to prevent these problems. And this isn't going to be easy either, because as we referred to earlier, again, in general, about one third of people want to avoid the truth. So, but if we can get two thirds of the people in this country to accept the truth about satisfying infants' needs, we'll be on the road to making a tremendous difference in preventing our personal and social problems.
I want to come back to that question of social problems, but first, I'm going to be a parent in 5 months from when we're recording, probably 4 months from when this show comes out.
Yeah,
we're looking at home birth. We're looking at co-sleeping. We're looking at a lot of the things you're talking about. And I'm wondering, you know, trauma is obviously something we want to avoid. Yeah. What other things should we as parents be looking at or going towards? It sounds like the opposite of trauma would be getting your child's needs met. Is that an accurate description of what we should be going towards instead, is understanding the child's needs and trying to meet them? Are there other things that we should look at to make sure that our child's needs are met? You know, what is it that we should be doing as parents to ensure that we're not contributing to this particular cycle of trauma?
Well, we should be aware of not doing anything that disrupts the bond between the infant and the mother. We should be aware of, again, as you say, satisfying the needs, maintaining the connection, physical, emotional, and psychological, between the infant and the mother. Trust the infant to tell us what he or she needs or wants, and allow that to happen in a safe way. I'm trying to recall here some of the other traumas. I think I mentioned non-maternal care. Too much non-maternal care is a disruption between the infant and the mother.
Meaning if the child's taken from the mother and cared for by someone else.
Right, right. And unfortunately, in this society, 55% of mothers of infants work outside the home. That's unheard of in other countries. And part of that problem is, again, here's the social or political aspect. Our national policy on maternal leave is 12 weeks of unpaid leave. That's our national policy. Some companies do better. That's our national policy. And even some states do better. In Europe, for example, European countries have between 1 and 3 years, years now, of paid maternal leave.
That sounds nice.
It's so supportive of families. And so it makes a tremendous difference on the quality of the bond between the child and the mother. And they can still be financially supported. But here, corporate profit, unfortunately, has a lot more support than families do in some cases. Okay, and we may give lip service to helping our families, but what comes in some cases, when it comes down to financial support, we're not always there, and that's going to take some public protest and contact to get on that case to make an improvement, because we are suffering long term and widely, you know, both people in poverty and people doing well. It's something we really need to give a lot more attention to.
It sounds like what you're describing is a systemic issue, meaning that it's not just one thing. The system we have is set up for a certain kind of value, which is, as a friend of mine likes to put it, we've detached our value from our values, meaning the value of money is, everyone says, you know, oh, children are our future. We value children, but our economic value and our definition of value there is very different from our stated personal values. Go ahead.
Well, you know, we're talking about adult behavior and choices at this minute. And I want to be clear that I make distinct and important connections. Again, I'm teaching about the origins of our emotional and behavioral problems. So if we want to make really significant long-term changes, the origins go back to infancy. And so we have a repeating cycle here that parents, for the most part, didn't get their early needs met. Okay, I'm saying today's parents, for the most part, didn't get their early needs met. And that contributes to a sense of alienation and disconnection. Because if you're disconnected from, here it is, when you're disconnected from your mother, that's a foundation for our connections to all humanity. Okay, because the mother is our primary intimate relationship. And so again, when that gets disrupted, it disrupts our connection to humanity. So with that disruption to humanity, I'm saying, there's a sense of alienation many people have from their connections with others. So with that sense of alienation, what's very common is a choice to conform without really doing your homework, without really considering other factors. We just tend to blindly conform. So, and of course, the area where we're talking about here, the conformity is to existing American cultural practices about how to care for infants and young children. So we pass on what was done to us to our own children, and then that repeats the cycle again, repeating the cycle to the next generation and the next generation. So again, it takes quite a bit of change in our awareness and consciousness to make the kind of choice that say your grandmother may not be happy with, or your friends may not approve of. But this is a very important lesson. Are you going to be true to yourself, or are you just simply going to copy what you see going on around you? Your integrity is on the line here. If you're aware that what you're doing might not be serving the best interests of your child, I mean, what is a higher value than the welfare of your child? There's another question to ask. And when you have the answer to that, what somebody else thinks or believes is lower down the totem pole, so to speak. Your child's welfare is the primary value.
I love that framing of it because it takes it straight to the question of identity, of who you are and how important your children are and what your values are. And I'm wondering for those of us who are interested in breaking the cycle of trauma, because I know that both me and my wife, we had our own early life experiences, which we've done a lot of work around integrating and healing. What are the things that we can do to change that within ourselves and then also change that within the wider society? In other words, what can we do to, go ahead.
When you say change that within ourselves, you're talking about as prospective parents or... I'm not sure.
So what I mean by that is, what are the things that we can do to ensure that we don't pass those on to our kids, that we don't act from them in our relationships? Because you talked about earlier how if you've experienced trauma, it sometimes causes people who've experienced it to be less aware of their own emotions and the emotions of others. And so for those of us who want to be more aware of our own emotions and the emotions of others, but maybe have had traumatic experiences, what are the things we can do to increase our awareness and to also ensure that that increased awareness is the place we're operating from when we raise our own children?
Okay, well, what comes to my mind is a couple of paths here. One is to explore your own emotional experience and history. Probably in a therapeutic environment. And my recommendation would be for these kinds of emotions, body-oriented or what sometimes called body psychotherapy, is the most effective because, again, it's the body, this repressed feelings in the body that are key here. A lot of therapy today is cognitive. It's in the head. It's intellectual. That can be of some value. And it doesn't easily get to early repressed feelings and experience that are beyond consciousness. You can't have cognitive therapy on what you're not aware of or conscious of. So I'm saying try doing some breath work is a term that's refers to some types of body-oriented therapy. So there's that path. For personal growth, okay? The other thing is, if you're a prospective parent, obviously the internet is a tremendous resource of information, a wide range of information, as we well know. But obviously you can make the choice of what to search for. So you can search for what's natural in terms of parenting. You can search for infant needs. Obviously, you go to my website where I have a blog. If you're not aware, at ronaldgoldmanphd.com. I got a blog that goes into some explanation of some of these issues we're talking about. So it's a combination of get to know yourself on a deeper level, possibly with therapeutic support, and then educate yourself to increase your awareness of making more informed choices.
I actually do Wim Hof breathing before the podcasting. It's one of the things that I do is to just sort of get in my body and get focused. I hadn't thought of using that in a specifically therapeutic way. So I'm wondering, is there other types of breath work I would look for if I was interested in that? Or is there a specific way of using it? Because I love breath work. I think it just on a physiological level feels really good. So I'm curious how you use it in that context.
Again, it's it's a question of how long you stick with it, what kind of facilitation you get, and trust your body. So let your body take you to the experience it needs or is ready for in terms of releasing and reliving, as the case may be. So, I mean, I went through this type of therapy many years ago over a long period of time. And it actually, I had an experience during one of these sessions where I experienced an early trauma, relived an early trauma as an infant. And at the end of the session, I walked out and I stopped and I said to myself, they're still doing this. And at that point, I had a tremendous compassion for infants in the present and in the future. And I vowed to myself, I have to do something about this. And for much of my adult life, I have been doing the best I can to do something about this. So again, it's a matter of persistence and taping the deeper path to trust your body. And it's not going to happen in one day or one week, but trust it. I believe it's very effective.
You know, your story, which I really appreciate, it's similar to the experience that I had that brought me to the work I'm doing now. One of the things that I think it points to is that when you do this work, when you integrate in some way or heal, that there's a resilience that comes from that. In other words, once you're aware of the feeling, then there's a greater compassion for others. And it sounds like for you, that compassion drives the work you do now. Of, I felt this thing, I experienced this, and I don't want anyone to experience it again.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that too, because a lot of people, I think, when they hear about healing work, they think it's going to be feeling bad all the time. And there are, you know, difficult feelings you have to be with, but it actually is really liberating afterwards. So I'm curious if you, when you've worked with people, or have you worked with people around integrating early life trauma? And if so, what sort of changes or things do you see when people actually do the work, when they actually explore those feelings or heal or integrate them in some way? What comes out on the other end of that?
Well, let me be clear. I'm not a clinician.
Sure.
My priority right now is public awareness and education. So I'm a public speaker. I'm a writer. And I'm working on another book in connection with early traumas. So I want to create as much awareness as possible among as many people as possible. And I also want to allude to something you said about feeling bad. I think you said something like that. Our usual perspective on bad feelings is avoid them.
Right.
Okay. That's not going to get us down a healing path. That's a roadblock. It's an emotional roadblock to getting beyond that point. Okay. In body psychotherapy, you may enter it with that kind of perspective, but as you do it, you recognize that expressing and releasing these stored, repressed bad feelings actually feels good. Get it out. Move past it. Again, get beyond the negative effect it's having by staying stored and repressed in your body. It can feel good to do that. And it may not happen in one session, but whatever number of sessions it takes, your body and your awareness recognizes you're making progress toward moving beyond these bad feelings by releasing them. And at some point, you will complete the release of certain feelings and negative experiences. And it feels good to move on. It just does.
It sounds too like the things that we would do to prevent early life trauma might also feel good. So, the, you know, if if the trauma is caused by separation, that the opposite of that would be connection. So yeah. What are the things, you know, again, because I'm having a child soon, what are the things that both me and my wife can do to support our child, to create more connection? We're already planning on a home birth and co-sleeping and things like that. But is there more that we could do? Are there things that...
Sure. Oh, yeah. Well, a big thing is virtual continual physical contact. I mean, again, this is what other primates do. It's what we continue to do in hunter-gatherer cultures, those that exist, tribal cultures. So this can be a mother predominantly wearing her baby. And so when you're wearing your baby, you know, you can walk around the house, you can go outside. I mean, you can do your tasks. And there are different, I mean, and there's websites about this. You can buy a sling, wear the baby on front, wear the baby on back. You know, obviously you can get support for that with those that sell these kinds of accessories. So there's that part. The other thing is co-sleeping. Again, this is what's natural, not what's cultural. It's what the baby needs. An infant does not want to be alone anytime, really. The infant needs continuous contact. Emotional contact, physical contact. So in many other cultures around the world, co-sleeping is the norm. And so, again, that's something that would be very strange to a lot of Americans because it's not what they experienced as children. It's not what they experienced if they were parents. And again, we need to... Are you open to new information?
You know I am by now.
Well, of course, I'm speaking to our audience, too. Mm-hmm. So that's a key question.
I think the kind of people who would listen to this are probably pretty open. But I want to go back to the question of you were talking earlier about how, as a society, these needs aren't usually met. And many of the social problems that we experience might be related to the early life, to basically the way that we systemically treat children. I was hoping you could talk more about that and what connections, if any, might exist there between our system around childhood and many of the adult problems that we experience.
Yeah. Well, again, if we're not sensitive to our own feelings, that also results in our not being sensitive to other people's feelings. Is violent behavior. Obviously, literally, physically injuring another person, including murder. And we have one of the highest murder rates. What is it? Our homicide rate in this country is 19 times the homicide rate in Japan, 9 times the homicide rate in China, and about 7 times the rate of homicides in European countries. So we've got a high rate of violence in this country. And again, that's obvious lack of empathy, sensitivity to others. So violence is a problem. A little bit about racism, which has been getting a lot of worthy attention. Overdue, I guess, is what I was looking for. That's an insensitivity to the feelings of people who look different than us. Okay? So someone who's racist notices the skin color and little else about what's common. We're both human beings. We have so many, as human beings, we have so many common abilities, features, sensitivities, psychological, physical. It's, there's just so much in common that can be a part of us connecting to each other rather than avoiding each other. Okay, so let me, this reminds me of something else. When we don't get our needs met, what happens to us psychologically has a negative effect on our self-esteem. Because a baby, again, this may not be so conscious, but a baby might, well, is it about me? Is mom not coming to me because there's something wrong with me? I mean, we may grow up thinking there's something wrong with us. Low self-esteem. Okay, so I guess somebody said once, the easiest idea to sell somebody else is to tell him that he's better than somebody else. So that's a crutch that some people may use to think they're better than people that look different than them, as a crutch for their own low self-esteem. So to avoid low self-esteem, we need to satisfy our infant needs, take better care of children starting from birth. And that can have a dramatic effect on improving our relationships with people who are physically different, but we're all humans. We share that.
One of the things that I've heard people push back on when this idea comes up is they'll say, oh, well, those other cultures are different than ours. And they'll try to attribute it to some cultural differences or things like that. So I'm curious what you'd say to people who say, well, the reasons we have these social problems in America are because of America and not just because of particularities about how we treat children.
So, I'm not sure what your question is.
So how is it that we know that there's a relationship between early life experiences and early life trauma and adult social problems? In other words, I think a lot of people, when
there's research on this.
So break that down, because I suspect most people aren't aware of that research.
Here's an example of a study that came to mind. This professional researcher, she observed preschool American children in a play area for a long time. And what she noticed was how often there's an aggressive behavior among these preschool children in the case where they're Americans. She noted how often they have aggressive behavior between each other. Okay, then she also observed in the same conditions, French children, preschool, same age range, same environment, how often they retreated each other aggressively. Here's the result. The French children treated each other aggressively about 3% of the time. American children, preschool children now, treated each other aggressively about 20% of the time. What does that tell you?
That's really
cultural. They do many things in French society to take better care of their children prior to preschool. Of course, we're talking about infants and very young children here, as compared to American children. And it shows in their behavior. And there's other studies that show that there's correlations between what we call insecure attachment. There's decades of, go Google this if you want. There's decades of research on attachment. Here are the researchers, John Bowlby, B-O-W-L-B-Y, going back decades, then Mary Ainsworth, A-I-N-S-W-O-R-T-H, and then Mary Main, M-A-I-N. These are the three primary psychological researchers on attachment, disrupted attachment, insecure attachment, and they were able to make connections between early lack of attachment or insecure attachment. This refers to the quality of the bond between the infant and the mother, and adult behavior. So it's right there in the literature. And again, most this is, you know, somewhat frustrating to me. It's been there for so long, and some very dedicated people went to a lot of work and commitment to do these studies. And for the most part, they get ignored. Like, I mean, all the answers are right there in the literature, and they get ignored. And, you know, I'm trying to do what I can to raise awareness, but a lot of people don't want to know it. It's too painful for them to become aware of. And we got to keep trying. And we need, there are millions of people who will welcome this information. We just need to make that connection and contact.
What do you think the key is to breaking through with this information? Because I've definitely wondered the same thing myself. And I know that there's a frustration that those who are aware of the information experience when you're sort of telling people this over and over and over again, and the social change is taking a while or resistant. And so I'm wondering what you think the way to take this research, which is well established, and bring it to the public consciousness or create some type of systemic change is.
It takes more people to make the effort to inform other people. So I say, for those watching us right now or listening to us, pass this information along to your friends, families, social contacts, the internet. I mean, people have literally reached millions of other people with certain information. So go for it. We can do it. We have the tools. We need the people to decide to, hey, what better use of your time than to help transform our society and subsequently the world to a higher quality of life that satisfies our human needs, and we reestablish our connections with each other to live more joy and less pain.
I'm curious.
What's a higher value than that? I don't know.
So I'm curious, though, why you think it is this information hasn't already spread. Is it just that the tools?
What I'm saying has not happened. A lot of researchers are dedicated to research.
Hmm.
Okay, that's a very important step. Do the research, but they're not looking to get on television shows and media. They're back to the research, or maybe they're teaching in college. Or they're hired by, you know, some kind of research organization. So, you know, I'm not in this for the money, you see. And I'm not being critical of anyone who is doing their job. You know, they've got whatever, dependents to support or whatever. That's okay. I'm in a place where I don't need to say, well, I'm going to get paid over there, so I'm going to do that. So that's a consideration for a lot of people. Okay, but hey, you know, this doesn't have to be your full-time job. If you did this for an hour a day to connect with people, to pass on the information we're talking about, and then you connected with 100 other people to do this an hour a day, and then, you know, what do they call it? Goes viral. Let's get this information to go viral. Okay, folks?
Well, I asked that because viral is a really interesting word. I know the word meme. I mean, obviously, you assume you're laughing because it's a very interesting word in the past year. But also the word meme, which as it was coined by Richard Dawkins, describes ideas as being like viruses, and that certain ones reproduce more than others do, and there's something I was working on writing earlier this week, talking about trauma as a sort of virus, meaning that it's something that gets in your system and then it hijacks the host to reproduce itself and to other people.
Yeah.
It sounds like you would agree with that analogy or description of it. And so one of the things I'm curious about is why trauma seems to be such an easily spread virus through society, whereas an idea like, hey, just really deeply connect to your children and understand their needs, you know, it seems to me that's a very positive message, yet it doesn't seem to spread as virally as practices that harm children or create trauma between people. And so I guess I'm curious is that just because the people who are researching haven't quite connected with media distribution necessary to spread the idea, or is it that there's something in the idea that makes one more viral than the other?
Well, it's not in the idea, it's how it affects us. So if we're traumatized, as I've said, we're less sensitive to our own feelings, other people's feelings, and we're very likely, if we become parents, to pass the trauma on to the next generation, repeating the cycle generation after generation. So that's the viral aspect, is repeating the cycle to the next generation. And as I mentioned previously, we're more likely to conform to things that aren't necessarily in our best interest or our children's interest, because conformity gives us the appearance of connecting to other people. We're getting approval of people if we do what they want us to do and do what they do. We need social approval to some extent, okay? To a lot of extent. And so the other part of my response is, we're resistant to change if we're traumatized. We're resistant to change if we're traumatized. We're resistant to the kinds of ideas we're putting out here because, again, it conflicts with our lifelong held beliefs and values. For me to say, sleep with your baby, not put your baby in another room. Somebody out there is going to believe it. That's absurd. Who would want to do that? You know, I don't want to do that. You know, there can't be any good reason for that. I mean, they can't get it. They're resistant to what's natural and what satisfies children's needs and what supports the bond between the mother and the infant. That's how humans are in certain situations based on their histories.
There was something really interesting in what you said about conformity seeming like connection.
Yeah.
It almost, because there's certain viruses that they get in your system by mimicking a natural function of the body, and your body thinks, oh, this is a part of me, or this is one of my cells, when it's actually the virus. And it sounds like conformity is almost a, like it looks like it's connection. It looks like it's the real thing when it's not. And then it sounds like also trauma itself has its own immune system and is naturally resistant to attempts of connection, of genuine connection.
Okay. Yes. I want to clarify about conformity. Conformity is, can happen when we're conforming to practices that are harmful, and it's also natural for us to conform when the culture is not dealing with trauma and infants are not dealing with trauma. So, for example, I'll refer to a book, The Continuum Concept.
I read that recently, and it's my favorite parenting book I've read thus far. I love that book.
All right.
Yes,
it's a wonderful book. Very briefly, it's a woman who went to the Amazon for a particular reason, had nothing to do with what we're talking about, and then she ended up observing one of the local tribes. And was amazed at their behaviors, and in particular how they raised their children. So she just decided to return and study and live with them, study how they raise their children, and then write a book about it, the continuum concept. So, okay, so what I'm saying here is in that natural environment, children learn by copying what they see others doing. So that's conformity. It's how they learn. And so parents don't necessarily have to overtly teach the children, this is how you do this particular task. What's more likely is the children just observe. They're with their parents anyway. They just observe what their parents do. And then they naturally want to do it themselves. So it doesn't necessarily require a teaching effort. Of course, when the child makes an attempt to do what the parent's doing, the parent will support the child by saying, oh, we'll make this little adjustment here and this will help you out and so forth and so on. It's very natural to conform when we are living our natural lives and supporting children more naturally. And when we don't get that, we tend to conform based on other perspectives and values, as I've said. And sometimes it can get us into trouble if we're going down a path of conformity that's not in our best interests.
One thing that book really made me think through is all, like, every habit in my life I now look at and go, oh, like, when the child is here, they're going to conform. Are they going to copy this habit? Is this one I actually want them to copy? You know, do I want my children to see me scrolling on my phone for an hour? Is that a habit I want to pass on? Do I need to drop that habit? Like, I'm serious. I'm going through every, you know, single part of my life. And then at the same time, there's some where I'm like, well, you know, I work on my computer. Maybe that's the world they're coming into, that is learning how to use the computer and do certain productive things on it is part of what they should do. But also, I don't know if I want my children spending that much screen time. Don't get them a cell phone.
Okay. I got a little more to say about that.
Sure.
There's research on young teenagers with cell phones. And the research generally says that the more they use their cell phones do all that young teenagers do with cell phones, it tends to be associated with a greater likelihood of depression. Okay. And a cell phone does not satisfy our need for social connection. Okay. And to pretend that it does is going to get you down a path. It's not going to help to satisfy your needs for social connection. And another little quick anecdote. In the past, I saw three young women, probably teenagers, walking down a sidewalk in a fairly busy part of a small town. Shoulder to shoulder now, they're walking down. So obviously they're with each other. And they're each looking at their own cell phones. No communication between them, shoulder to shoulder. That's an image I have never forgotten.
I mean, it does sound like even in that image, there's an instinctual desire for connection. They weren't walking separately. They were still, you know, there's an unconscious going toward for that. I think about that too with the technological stuff, because social media and things like that are not connection, but they do give you a feeling like connection. I have a friend who likes to call it empty calorie connections. It's the thing where, like, you feel like you're getting the connection. It's kind of like when you eat fast food or junk food. Like, it feels like food, but it's not quite, you know, getting the nutritional needs of actual food or actual connection. Anyway, this is a tangent from the early life stuff, but it's made me think of that.
Okay. It's not an all or nothing choice, obviously.
Sure.
It's a matter of degree, and it's personal. I mean, obviously, and with children too, if they have a, if they have their own electronic devices, then they have the option of deciding when they're going to use them. I mean, obviously it's parental discretion about if and when you provide electronic devices for your children, and also monitoring your own choices of how many hours a day are you using these things and what kind of model are you exhibiting for your children.
I do like the guide of connection and the need for connection as a way to decide this, because I think a lot of people get caught up in the arbitrary specifications of the technology and they're thinking about what does this particular app do, as opposed to just the meta question of like, am I connecting with my kids? Are my kids getting enough connection? Are they learning what connection is? Are they learning how to connect to another person? Is that something that an iPad could teach them? Or is that something that only I, as another human being, can teach them? So are there any other things that we can do to create greater connection between ourselves and our children, or the people around us with the information that you've shared? Is there any other... It sounds like you actually, by the way, connection is the solution for the larger question of getting this information out, as we have to connect more people to it. Yeah. So are there any other thoughts you might have or suggestions around how we can create more connection?
Give me a moment.
Sure.
Okay. Did I mention corporal punishment?
We haven't talked about that yet, but I suspect anyone who's been following this conversation could probably guess your perspective on that.
Okay, well, let me just add a couple of relevant information here.
Sure.
Corporal punishment is very common in this country. Most children in this country are hit by their parents. The common form, of course, is spanking, but it goes beyond that. One interesting relevant fact here is that even infants are sometimes hit by caregivers and parents. Infants now. And the research shows about 1 out of 3 infants.
Wow.
That's amazing, are hit by parents and caregivers. Okay, now corporal punishment teaches children that violence is okay. If my parents are doing it, it must be okay. Okay, this is another example where there are decades of research to show many harmful short and long-term effects of corporal punishment. Okay, another thought I want to mention here is there are 60 countries in the world that have agreed to a national policy of advocating no corporal punishment of children in any setting, including the home. 60 countries. It's probably no surprise that the United States refuses to sign on to that agreement. So, the United States also has refused to sign on to, I think it's the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. No, we don't recognize rights to children in this country very easily or being widespread. So getting back to corporal punishment, children who are hit are more likely to hit others when they grow up. They even when they grow up, they're more likely to hit their own parents because they're growing up with suppressed anger about having been hit when they were younger children. Okay, they're more likely to hit their own kids. They're more likely to engage in violent behavior. They're more likely to engage in domestic violence. I don't remember if I said it. One out of 4 women in this country will be subjected to domestic violence at some point by a partner. Sometime in adulthood, 1 out of 5 women will be raped at some point in her life. So we've got a tremendous problem with violent behavior, and we're deluding ourselves if we think corporal punishment is not a significant factor in contributing to this problem of violence.
You know, sometimes I forget what a bubble of highly conscious people that I socialize with. Because to me, when I hear that, I'm just like, I can't imagine why would anyone do that. But at the same time, I know most people have experienced that growing up. And when I talk to most, even my friends who come from or are trying to create highly conscious communities and families, they're like, yeah, that's how I was raised. It's part of the reason I'm not doing it now. It makes sense to avoid. Is there anything else that you want to add that I haven't asked about yet or that we haven't gotten a chance to talk about?
Well, we've covered a lot. How's our time?
We're good there.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, we have Ron, I have all the time in the world. If you have things that you want to share, I think this is important. I will ask, since we're closing now, where can people find you, or what, if someone hears this information and they agree and they want to take action, where should they go? What action should people take?
Okay. Give me a moment. Let's see. Okay. Well, in addition to making better personal choices in terms of being prospective parents and passing that information along in terms of, you know, recommending or suggesting, there's something the culture can do. I call these cultural principles of peace. If it relates to violent behavior, but it can be more than that. We need to have better economic, political, and social support for families. And as I've said, the extended paid parental leave would go a long way toward that. We need more and improved parenting and child development education in our universities and elsewhere. We need reconsideration of our cultural priorities. And in particular, of course, that would relate to the welfare of families as opposed to other existing priorities that are higher up on the scale. Maybe we can, you know, make a transition there. I also recommend that women be more assertive regarding infant and child care. Women, generally speaking now, are more in contact with their instincts and emotions, by that method, they would be able to more responsibly respond to infant and child care. So the point is here, if there's a disagreement with, for example, the father of the child, don't give up on your assertiveness simply because the father says, let's do X instead of Y. Okay. Generally speaking, more open communication and wherever it can be effective. And then, so what other people can do, as I've said, communicate with others who may have children in the future, contact news sources, share with social media, contact local, state, and federal representative to support families. And, you know, at the lower level, it's a little easier to get response than at the higher level, but let's go after all of them. And with these representatives that we have, start talking to them and communicating about extending paid parental leave. We need it. Other countries have it. Why not us? And I could conclude here with a couple of important quotes. First, what's done to children, they will do to society. That's said by psychiatrist Carl Menninger. And then, if we're to have real peace, we must begin with the children. Said by Mahatma Gandhi.
Speaking of social change, by the way, as I understand it, you have a piece of social change that you're working on as well. Are you still involved in an attempt to get circumcision removed from Medicaid? Is that part of something you're working on?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned it. Yes, I have initiated a case here in the state of Massachusetts to challenge a state Medicaid program, which is called MassHealth, which pays for circumcisions for those who are using MassHealth or state funding because they can't afford to pay their own health expenses or have insurance on healthcare. So the key thing here is the funding for Medicaid by regulation explicitly says it should only be for necessary medical services. Okay. And nobody claims that male infant circumcision is medically necessary. Nobody, no doctor, no society, no policy statement. So I don't know if this is unique or not, but Massachusetts has a regulation that says that if a sufficient number of taxpayers get together, it happens to be 24, and sign a petition that supports challenging an abuse of a state department or an irresponsible use of fundings by a state department, they can be taken to court based on this regulation, but they can be taken to court to have the court decide if the case is won, that the state department, in this case, MassHealth, should stop paying for Medicaid circumcisions. So we had, it's been a while. We had a court hearing earlier this month, and we're awaiting the decision. And certainly I'll make it known when the decision is made. But obviously this would be very important if we could get a supportive decision by the judge.
Is there a way that people can support that, or is that just something we're going to have to wait and see what happens with it?
Well, we're going to have to wait and see. Yeah.
All right.
It's in the judge's hands. And when that is decided, then, you know, my team will decide on our next steps and we'll make suggestions to others on what they might do to contribute.
Okay. Is there anything else that you want to add before we finish the show?
Oh, that's it. We've covered a lot.
Cool. Well, thank you.
I appreciate what you've done in your work, too.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan Marotta Show. If you liked this episode, please share it with someone else who would also like it, and then go on whatever platform you listen to the show on and leave a positive review. If you want to support the show directly, go to brendanmarotta.com/show and subscribe there. Paid subscribers get special unreleased bonus material and live events that are only available to them. Once again, that is brendanmarotta.com/show. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you all later.